Recording once more.
Record.
I'm recording.
What was that?
What the fuck's going on down there?
This is a spoiler podcast. If spoilers will obliterate your ability to view Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, this is your final chance to turn back. There will be no more spoiler warnings. There will be no more mercy. The hour of reckoning has come. And Transformers Revenge of the Fallen will be discussed in full. Farewell, my devoted fans. My hour has come.
Hi everyone, this is Vangelis. This is WTF at TFW, and we're going to talk about a feature-length film today. And it's called Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, and there's some people who kind of like it, and there's some people who kind of don't like it, so we're going to discuss that film in question. And there's a bunch of us here today. I'm here with Aaron.
Hello.
And I'm here with Gogdog.
Hello.
And I'm here with Lupus Convoy.
Hello.
And I'm here with Seth Buzzard.
What's happening?
And I'm here with Omegas Prime.
Hello, everyone.
And, yeah, we all watched Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, a feature film made for viewing in feature film movie theaters, rated PG-13, etc., etc. So, we're going to do this like our animated discussions, where I just basically go through the list and ask everyone to bring up a talking point that they thought was palpable and worth mentioning. So we're not going to do, like, a synopsis of the movie or anything, in part because, A, it's long, and B, I haven't hit up the torrent to do so. So I'll just start off at the top of the list with the man who helped us set our recording time today, Aaron.
Yay! Yeah, I guess I was. Wow. Okay. A point to start with. I'll go for something completely random with the kitchen scene as the little shard of the Allspark makes all of the little kitchen appliances come to life, and the garbage disposal totally look like a Sharkticon from G1.
I didn't even actually look for
this.
It was a little stumpy round thing with a tail and a vortex hole mouth.
I was just looking at the dick gun myself.
But somebody else caught that.
I actually have to give props to the everybody that went with me to the theater. I had them write down a bunch of points, and that way I didn't have to take notes. They did.
Oh, many congratulations. Who are they?
Gerardimus and my wife and my brother is fiancé. Couple other random comic book store people, too.
Oh, excellent. Thanks, guys. So, yeah, the kitchen bots are clearly going to make for a whole lot of opportunity to have various scout toys in the near future, I guess.
Yeah, that's. I had to lean over to everybody and say, and they're making the toaster. So I think I made two sales on that, so.
Yeah, anyone else like the kitchen bots?
I love the aftermath. I love watching Bumblebee senselessly blow up houses.
Indeed. Well, I have a whole thing about Bumblebee being a bit of a codependent psychopath in this film, but I'll leave that alone for now. Yeah, kitchen bots were cool. Anyone else want to chime in about them?
Yeah, they were goofy little gremlin kind of critters. Just more of kind of playing off that idea from the first movie when the Allspark gets set off and bringing machines to life. Although they seem pretty organized to go straight upstairs where Sam was.
Like the Dyson vac with the 6-round gun. I think that was the other one that really grabbed my attention. Then all the other random appliances turn into insectoid things and move on.
Yeah. Well, it's worth noting also that if people are wondering why they all wanted to eat Sam for whatever reason, I think it was cleared up by the writers that they believe any feral Transformer, that being something brought to life by the Allspark energies like that, would be basically like a little wild predator animal. So I'm guessing the reason why they had a pack mentality was that they were all born at the same time, or maybe, you know, kitchen appliances actually do talk to each other.
Yeah, maybe it's like animated, where any machine that gets brought to life has a previous memory of its life in as the machine. But it was kind of curious because Michael Bay was quoted in an interview as saying that while they were making the movie, he was curious to know how Transformers were born, so he went to Hasbro and asked them, you know, how were Transformers born? And he claims the response he got was, we don't know. Which, whatever, that may or may not be true. But, so then we see later, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in detail later, but the Decepticons on their ship have what are called hatchlings, which look to be maybe like either child Transformers that already have sparks, or maybe just protoforms, you know, that mm-hmm. haven't been brought to life yet or something. They really didn't go much into detail with it, but it was kind of interesting, though, how they made a concept of Transformers being quote-unquote born, but they already had established the fact of the Allspark, you know, creating life from whence there was none. So
yeah.
I thought that was an interesting parallel that they didn't really explore all that much.
Yeah, but there seems to be some discrepancy in that concept of the Allspark being the thing that creates life, when it was explained that these little critters that get made don't have sparks, and that's why they're crazy animals. So where do sparks come from? And it's just the whole thing. It's like they give kind of little glimpses, but then mm-hmm. they don't follow through on anything, and some of the things seem to sort of contradict. And just showing the hatchlings was like an unnecessary detail, like I
yeah.
thought. Like, here's
yeah,
this
yeah.
thing that we're never going to revisit in this movie and leave completely up in the air, and it just seemed weird.
Yeah, and another discrepancy about that, too, was at least in the prequel comics, if I remember correctly, if not, someone please correct me, but, wasn't it said that the Primes were the original Transformers that were created by the Allspark, but yet they couldn't transform, but the Primes created the first transforming Cybertronians, you know, quote-unquote Transformers,
yeah.
but yet when we see the Allspark create life, it can transform from the get-go. So, it's still a little bit of a discrepancy.
What you saw was the Allspark 2.0.
I guess. that might very well be true, because they said that their history and everything was contained in the Allspark, so it's possible that maybe the Primes did modify it to suit their needs. And that's how they did create the Transformers, was through them modifying it. So it would be nice if we got a little bit more clarification on that, but because it does lead to a little bit of confusion. Well, I'm totally in the group that likes to have some things left to imagination. When you have things on screen that definitely contradict one another, like Seth said, sometimes it leads to a little more confusion than maybe yeah. what's necessary. But I mean, and I'm not complaining about it. It's just something that I notice. It's far from a gripe that I have.
Yeah, and I think it's something that it kind of surprised me in a bit of a disappointing way, only because when I was at BotCon, I basically said, like, you know, the prequel movie comics for the first movie, there were so many discrepancies, in part because the movie was kept under wraps so much, and I was kind of like, did you guys, you know, have more contact this time? And it sounded like they did, and clearly they did, because there's more connection, but discrepancy still seems to be one of the key words to keep in mind when exploring the universe of the movie Transformers.
Yeah, I just read the plot synopsis, or a synopsis for the prequel comics. I didn't really get into it, but the way it sounded to me was that the earliest Cybertronians didn't transform, but the Primes did, that they were the first ones that transformed. And if the Fallen is one of those original Primes and his toy transforms, we don't see him transform in the movie, do we?
No.
He just teleports?
I think so.
Other than, well, he does come to Earth and hit the aircraft carrier. So he at least has his re-entry slash asteroid.
Well, maybe. I mean, yeah, but then again, the Fallen can teleport. He may have just teleported there. We don't know.
He just decided to appear there, and then some other meteor knocked the aircraft carrier over, and he was all like, "You cretin!"
He did have, like, one little scene during the climax where he teleported in and kind of vaguely kind of almost looked like he was in flight mode or...
Oh, is that when he took the Matrix?
Yeah, he might have just been really tucked together, though.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell.
The DVD is going to be fun to freeze frame through, I think is the key word there. let's move on to GOG, if you got something you'd like to bring up.
Yeah, and kind of staying on the same theme of discrepancies versus comics. And actually, I don't know if this was a comic discrepancy. It may have been a prequel novel. I'm trying to remember, because a lot of this information, especially after having the movie basically just pump information into your eyeballs for 3 hours, sometimes you forget where you read certain things. But I remember reading at one point that and now that I think about it, it might have been from the prequel novel, so... I'm trying to remember. Anyway, but I had read somewhere that the movie was supposed to explain the reason that why the Allspark came to Earth was because the Sun Harvester was actually supposed to recharge the Allspark. So when the Allspark was hurled into space, it detected or felt like some sort of magnetism-esque attraction. And that's why the Allspark landed on Earth, was because it was basically being attracted by the Sun Harvester, and the Sun Harvester was actually what was supposed to recharge the Allspark. And so they didn't in the movie all they said for the Sun Harvester was it creates energon. That must be a hell of a lot of energon for a Sun Harvester to basically drain an entire star to create, you know, a...
Well, that's what I liked about the concept.
It was fairly small.
Like they were...
Wasn't the Allspark before the Sun Harvester? Didn't they say it had been millions of years in the first movie?
They said that when they found it, the carbon dating put it at tens of thousands.
Okay, and then what was it, 13,000 BC?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'd have to go back and listen exactly, but... I just remember reading that at one point, that so that might have just been something that they had inserted into the prequel novel, a little bit of writer's creative liberties. I'm not sure. Was that in the comic?
I don't recall it being explicitly in the comic. It might have been in there as like a throwaway line, but I don't fully recall. That's the thing, is I don't know. It's a little disappointing, because I was hoping that this would be the case where, now that this whole fiction is out in the blue and, you know, there's no more top secret whatever, we could have all the ancillary fiction be really meshed in with the movie. Not to the point of you having to have read it to understand the movie, but I don't know. The discrepancies are kind of disappointing, but I guess the entertainment factor lies in just trying to figure out ways to fit them in, if you do so choose.
I guess.
I did just read on Twitter about a fellow who apparently spent multiple hours having a conversation about how the comic book could possibly chronologically fit into the movie, and I almost wanted to ask him why he decided to enter into sadism, but or masochism, depending what end of the conversation he was on. But, it's a bit weird. And it was odd also how in the movie the Allspark shards, which were such a big deal... you know, upon retrospect, I could tell what happened to them, but it felt kind of like the glasses in the first movie, where they were a really big deal and then suddenly weren't.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they were one-shot use kind of things.
Yeah.
Like, used it once, done, throw it away.
I mean, plot-wise, I mean, the original, the Allspark fragment we see at the end of the first movie was important because, you know, they wanted to bring Megatron back online. So it was kind of important, but like you said, it kind of disappeared after that and was never really mentioned again. And I mean, did the Decepticons still have it? You know, because
they jammed it into Megatron.
Well, yeah, but then again, we see Frenzy, and he wasn't dead, so maybe there's a difference. Again, you know, something we didn't really get any explanation with. But we see Frenzy in the first movie basically lose 75% of his body, and the Allspark just regenerates him. So if the Allspark fragment contains, you know, the energy from you know, similarly to the full Allspark did. You know, maybe it, I mean, it, did it just heal him? I mean, is it, does he, you know, we don't really know, we don't really know what happened. So, I don't know.
I have a theory relating to that, but I'll save that for a little bit, before I take us totally off. Let's continue down the line. Lupus, have you got anything you'd like to bring up about the film?
Okay, not to totally get into the bad part of this, but the combining aspect of Devastator and how absolutely vicious and cool it was.
Yes!
It wasn't just, like, body parts floating through the air and they neatly stick into each other. No, giant clawed cables come out of one of the components and they all just rip and force each other onto one another. Very, very primal. That went along very well with the actual style of the character and its appearance.
I'm so happy that so many people could finally see that scene, so I'd stop describing it, and apparently for some, hi Andy, making it sound way better than it actually was for them to view. friend of mine, Cobra Commander TFW, I'd explained the scene to him in so much detail, I actually set him up and disappointed him, because he thought there was even more that was going to happen. But no, I really enjoyed seeing the scene, and there were bits of it that I hadn't remembered from BotCon, I guess because I had had, you know, a couple fresh rums in me. But there was this high-pitched whine in the background that would crescendo up and up and up in pitch. And I really loved that, because it just added to the urgency of the scene.
Well, at BotCon, there was also no way to hear any of that. Like, yeah. I only caught, like, three or four words that John Turturro spoke when we saw it at BotCon. It was nice being actually able to hear what he was talking about there.
Yeah. I did have some, like, unfortunately a negative to bring up after that, but I guess I'll hold off on that for just a sec. Anyone else have any comments on Devastator combining? I guess those of us at BotCon can just kind of go like, aha, that was still cool.
Yeah, well, like Lupus said, I had the exact same reaction about it being violent, and I even leaned over. I was sitting next to Empire from the message board, and I just said, I love how violent this is.
Yeah. Are we just going to talk about just the combining, or since we're on the topic, are we just going to talk about Devastator in general?
If you guys want to, I guess we could, because I got something I could drop unless anyone else wants to specifically go into the combining. Anyone who wasn't at BotCon, Omegas, did our descriptions actually suit the combining?
Well, in typical Vangelis fashion, you did make it sound far more epic than I expected it to be. I mean, it was awesome. It was awesome to see, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, it was going, this is going by pretty quick. That's it? It's over?
Well, that I did have that feeling.
What did you want him to do? Somersault through a hula hoop and teleport to Mars or something?
I did!
I mean,
although
the thing better be on fire.
I did have that feeling myself because, you know, the BotCon footage ended with Devastator rearing his head up, and I thought, oh, something awesome's going to happen now. So when I saw it in the movie, I was like, oh, something awesome's going to happen now. And then they cut to a completely unrelated scene. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It just seems like with movie construction and complexity, I would expect a combination sequence that was longer than, say, the stock footage combinations from either G1 or the Unicron trilogy.
I was okay with the length myself. It's more so the follow-up that actually really got me kind of, like, down. Because I felt bad for Devastator, really. I think he got screwed over.
Yeah.
I got something to say about Devastator's follow-up.
Yeah, well, I'm probably going to end up agreeing with it, if going by the way you're coming at it. So, Seth, what are your words on the follow-up?
Devastator did nothing in the movie. He forms, and that was awesome, and then he starts sucking everything up, and that was kind of cool. But then Skids is able to punch his way out of his face, and then he stumbles up the side of the pyramid, clumsily slipping and sliding the whole way, only to finally get shot by a fancy gun on a battleship that's like 30 miles away. And then that's the end of Devastator. It's like, and when they blasted Devastator and he falls dead, I was like, that can't be it. That's all they're going to do with Devastator. Wow.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, in defense of Devastator, he did unearth the Sun Harvester and keep the.
Yeah.
I mean, basically put the Earth in completely in danger of the device actually being used. So I think in the right. script, it probably played out a whole lot cooler than. And I'm going to get into more of that subtext in a moment, but. I think as a plot device, his purpose and probably why the Constructicons all were rallied on that location was when they merged, they were probably going to make a beeline for the pyramid and basically, you know, unearth the Sun Harvester.
Right. And then well, his chain thing seemed to be
became a distraction,
pulling a lot of blocks off too when he was going. I wonder if it wasn't half pull himself up, half tear some of this off, because there as soon as he got to the top, he shouldered that off, and it looked like he was starting to pull more stuff back away from the Sun Harvester before he got hit in the jubblies.
Yeah. I mean, it was obvious he was trying to unearth the thing as much as possible, and it's a little sad that they had to completely come up with a Deus Ex Machina to take him down. Yeah. It's like Totoro's going to be like, oh, well, I don't have a security clearance anymore, but yet I know about a top secret weapon that no one except for high-level military clearance knows about. And then they use it, and then it's never mentioned again.
Yeah, it's a one-shot kill.
Yeah, and it's this ultra-secret, high-level, nobody-knows-about-it gun that's just on the deck of a ship. It's not like the ship had to open up. And the gun comes from below deck or something.
Yeah, and off the coast of Egypt. So
very conveniently.
So that was a little lame. I mean, it doesn't. Again, it's definitely not on my top list of problems with the movie. But it just like come on, you could have had a better. Yeah. Way. I mean, it's and again, it's kind of better than I expected because we all kind of knew, especially from the coloring book, that John Turturro was going to scale the pyramid and take down Devastator. And I was just like, when he started running up the blocks, I was like, okay, here we go. What's he going to do? And at least it was a giant prototype military weapon that took him down versus an old Italian dude. So
has it been John Turturro to just fist a custom going like, I'm one man! Just like punch him in the jaw.
Well, I would much rather have seen Devastator be defeated in an actual battle and not sniped from a distance.
Oh, I agree. That's what I'm saying. Is the only thing they could come up with to beat Devastator was basically something that they just pulled out of their ass for that purpose, and then we never saw again. I would have much rather,
well,
just like
it was
you said.
It seemed more to me like he served his purpose. Now we got to get rid of him because he's too big and ominous to be in the rest of the movie. So we just got to get rid of him.
Yeah, and when I saw Devastator
footage...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just reiterating, basically.
Wow. Well, when I saw Devastator footage, for me, it was like, I thought he was going to be the climax of the movie. And his combination sequence was a climactic scene that didn't happen in the climax of the movie. So I just felt like he was wasted, generally. That he could have been used for so much more, and... And it didn't help that when he got shot, he exploded into, like, component construction vehicles, and they just kind of sat there. I was like, are they at least going to, you know, turn into robots and scatter around and... No? Oh, okay.
Well, that's a theory that we kind of came up with talking after the film, Jared and I, was that I wonder if the guys that transform into Devastator can't turn into robots, thus making all of the toys movie accurate.
Yeah,
except
because we see two sets of the dump trucks. We see two or three or four of the
bulldozer.
Whips McCracken. What's the bulldozer Rampage? Or
Rampage,
whatever.
Rampage.
Yeah. Rampage.
You know,
and
does that mean that
Jumpin' Jack or
there's
whatever
one,
his name is?
Yeah, there's one set of them that are Devastator and one set that aren't Devastator.
Yeah, and although honestly, I don't know, the whole way that played out, it's just like it looked for all intents and purposes like it was going to be more awesome than it turned out on that end. To me, it was a palpable disappointment for me in the movie. Although I will maintain I love the combining sequence. I thought that was perfect. I just wish that there was a nice follow up to it that gone with it better.
Yeah, that the combining was just amazing.
I would have liked to see a fight between, you know, the six or seven, how many ever, Constructicons, and a group of Autobots, and then those guys combine to make Devastator and beat up one of the token Autobots and then go and do what they did rather than
show
what we
up.
Got. Although, I mean, it was still good. I'm not going to say, oh, this is terrible, but I think that would have been more dramatic in that it's like, okay, well, we're doing a decent job of holding our own. Holy shit.
Yeah.
See, they build up so many Autobots in that scene. That's what I thought the whole final battle was going to be. You know, Devastator versus like six, seven different Autobots that are just scattered around.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, well, at least Devastator apparently does more in the games, so I have to give him props there. I'm really enjoying the games for offering some alternate looks at the story that I'm enjoying a bit more, actually. let's continue down the list. Seth, you got something you'd like to bring up?
Yeah. Not a plot issue, but maybe a filmmaking issue. I thought the editing in a lot of sections were just sloppy and ham-fisted. When we see, like, Sam at the frat party, and Bumblebee picks him up, they drive away, it's nighttime, they dump off Alice, it's nighttime, and then all of a sudden they're in a cemetery during the day with no explanation that Bumblebee was there to take Sam and that it was any sort of distance. There was a few other scenes like that too where it was just really hard, kind of sloppy cuts that kind of broke up the flow.
How about going from Washington, D.C. and the Museum of Flight or whatever, then out to the middle of the desert for the...
Yeah.
Next part of that scene, or the fact that Devastator's on a pyramid tearing it apart, but in the background you can see the same pyramid since it's the central of the three that has the limestone case still on it that he's knocked off, but then you see that in the background, or the fact that they drive halfway across Egypt and can still see the pyramids.
Or my favorite one is Michaela gets on a plane and flies to Sam's university all in the space of about 5 minutes. That was my favorite one.
Yeah, that thing with them being in the museum and then walking out to the desert, that totally took me by surprise, because I was like, wait, I thought they were... Then I started second-guessing myself. I was like, well, I must have misunderstood them. You know, they must have gone somewhere else, because I've been to Washington, D.C., and I've been right outside the Smithsonian. I'm pretty sure behind it is not a vast desert. So,
behind the Smithsonian is more D.C.
Yeah, but didn't they literally just... They walked out the back of the museum, and now they're in a desert.
They walk out hangar doors, and then they're in a boneyard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's not, like, a case of sloppy editing, like, with the driving to the cemetery. You see the doors open, and out the back of the door is... the boneyard in the desert.
Yeah,
and if it was sloppy editing, then it was, okay, let's leave, and then they cut out the scene where they all climb into Jetfire and they fly to the desert. But they got really loose with geography in that movie. Like, the distances between the pyramids and the Gulf and Jordan and all these countries, like, everything was, like, no more than 10 miles from anything
else. Yeah, because Jordan doesn't border Egypt, does it? Isn't there, like, isn't Israel or something in between it?
I don't know.
In the movie verse, they blew it up. There you go. No, actually, this is my explanation for everything. Random space bridges opened by Jetfire, starting with when he body checked the hangar bay open. He opened a space bridge there to the desert. And then he clearly left a few more scattered around Egypt when he landed there. So there you go.
Yeah. And wouldn't the Egyptian military wouldn't they have been able to respond faster than the Jordanian military?
Well, you see, the Egyptian military was busy because the doctor was running amok.
Oh.
And that's what he was doing.
Sure.
The doctor...
Wow, so you just insulted the entire Egyptian armed forces by saying a tiny little skittering microscope ties up their whole army.
Dude, the doctor...
Wow.
No, it wasn't just the
doctor.
Wow,
dude.
The doctor teamed up with the two dogs that Sam's parents have, because that's where they all went. And that was the end of their road trip, was they ran amok around Egypt, and through circumstance caused the entire Egyptian armed forces to have to come after them. It's all going to be detailed in my fan fiction.
Is it going to be titled "I Hate Egypt" by Vangelis?
It's never anything easy like, oh, that's where Scorponok was the whole fight, or no, that's what Barricade was doing during this movie. No, you gotta work in Mojo and the Doctor. And
yeah, Mojo, the Doctor, yeah. And Barricade, and whatever the other dog was. That's where they all met up. And then Bone Humpy. Crusher joined them. So there you go. I don't know why you guys can't come up with these explanations. It's pretty easy. Yeah, There was some great epic time jumping in that movie. Hey, Omegas, have you got a point you'd like to bring up?
Well, I'm glad no one brought this up, because this is so poignant for me to say that I loved Wheelie.
Me too!
Yeah.
Jesus, such a funny little character in this one. And I was so glad. I mean, there's just some times where I just go, you're really going to rebrand this character into this and this, you know, and I always feel like, well, if you name a brand new character sideways and they become, like, more prominent than previous sideways, you're never going to be able to go backwards. It's always going to be, that's the one you have to go to. In this case, I am perfectly happy replacing the old Wheelie with this one.
No, this Wheelie was awesome. I love this Wheelie.
The leg-humping... easily confused, eye-burnt guy.
This Wheelie was great simply because he was, like, trying so hard to be a badass and then going back on his actions constantly. I don't know. His voice acting really made it for me. And I thought I was going to hate him, and I ended up loving him, so that helped, too.
Yeah.
Which really was the story of me and the twins as well, because I'd spent this entire time thinking the twins were going to be Hicks up until I saw them in the movie. I think that's one reason why I ended up liking the twins, is they ended up so different than how I'd expected. But Wheelie was great. I just wish that, you know, Wheelie didn't do what half the other characters in this movie did, and have a line walk into a building and then disappear forever.
Oh, yeah. He had parts where he would magically vanish, like when they're running up to try and talk to Jetfire. And you see all four of them run around, and Wheelie's nowhere to be found. Then, after Jetfire talks, they just cut back to Wheelie all of a sudden.
Well, he's so small that you don't notice him.
Well, but his last scene, he walks into this building, and he actually goes, like, you Autobots, you know, we got work to do. And then he's gone. And I was like, wait, what? So, apparently he spent the rest of the movie, like, reading maps or something.
Jeez. See, that's how Devastator should have been destroyed. He should have just, like, crawled into him and started pulling wires.
That's how I was expecting him to be destroyed, or something like that. Although I mean, not to take this off topic, but I did cheer inside when the twins, you know, when one of them, when Mudflap busted out of Devastator's face and they just started double-teaming him. I did.
Yeah.
Get a little
that was cool. That, I'm not a big, well, I guess we'll go more into detail about the twins later, but I wasn't a huge fan of their implementation or characterization in the movie, but... When they finally just decided to actually work together, and they show that when they do put their minds to it, they can be an emotionally charged good team up. That was pretty neat. But as far as Wheelie goes, I really liked Wheelie as well. I didn't really like the leg humping scene, and it wasn't necessarily because it was vulgar or anything like that, but I didn't like the leg humping scene because. It doesn't make sense for a robot to hump a girl's leg.
No, you know? Yeah.
It's like he tells her, it's like, you're hot, but you're not all that smart. It's like the whole trying to give a robot character by making him attracted to a human female. I didn't really buy that part. Other than that, though, I liked him.
I wasn't a fan of the leg humping. Like John Turturro's thong, it was one of those scenes where I'm certainly not going to stand up for it, but. It is classified as one of those scenes where I also don't feel that it should be able to ruin an entire movie for someone, given how short it was.
Yeah, I agree.
But I'm definitely not going to go like, maybe... no, dude, the leg humping was awesome!
Maybe if when Wheelie was sort of like sneaking around, if he had witnessed Mojo raping the new dog and like learned the behavior that way, then it might have made sense. But it just seemed... It just seemed like there they decided there wasn't enough dog style humping, so Wheelie has to pound his pelvis against Michaela's ankle for a while.
What really got me was Michaela didn't even. It wasn't so much she didn't care about it. She struck me as not really minding it either.
No, she actually smiled. Yeah. She giggled when it happened. She was loving it.
I was like, "What have you like? What kind of sensories have you got on the side of your legs, Sheesh. Megan Fox?"
At least something's humping me around here. Hint, hint.
Sam's line when he sees it was actually what I was thinking. Like, what are you allowing to happen right now? Like, yes, thank you for pointing that out for the rest of us.
Yeah, I would like to. I would like to think each Transformer just kind of pulls whatever personality they like best, and somewhere Wheelie got that was a sign of affection. Which, judging by his nature, I would not be surprised that he went to a few credit card required websites to learn that.
My only downside with Wheelie is I liked him so much in the film that now I like his toy less. Because I didn't mind his toy that much, because, you know, it didn't really look totally like him, but, you know, I was like, well, you know, who's going to care that much about Wheelie? Then I ended up caring that much about Wheelie, so now I really want an accurate Wheelie toy.
Someone told me that one of his...
Before I saw the movie, I was kind of upset with my Wheelie toy purchase, and now I'm like, hey, I can get him to hump things now.
Yeah.
I haven't taken a look, but someone told me that they actually molded each eye differently. So he actually has the burnt eye.
Yeah, that's true.
Really?
They're both the same color, but they have different patterns on the eyes. Yeah,
a little bit of different pattern on it, but that I don't think that's one supposed to be burnt.
Doesn't help that they made them yellow.
Yeah.
I want my screen accurate Wheelie, please.
Oh, it's the movie line. Everything will get battle damaged eventually.
I want premium Wheelie. Hydraulic hip action. Yeah, I enjoyed Wheelie. In fact, a friend of mine, Jacob, who generally doesn't like the quote-unquote irritating characters, actually enjoyed Wheelie as well, which surprised the hell out of me.
That was Tom Kenny that did the voice work, too.
Yeah, well, Tom Kenny did a great job. Yeah. That whole scene when he's breaking into the safe remains one of my favorites. I'm really glad it's online for reviewing. Poor dude. His eye all burnt.
On a chain in a box.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, Michaela really showed her dark side. If you're nice, I won't have to burn your eye again. What?
What movie did we just see?
I still like the discussions about the German version of that being hotter, but I'll leave that.
Yeah, it was definitely better in German.
Aber Frau Pain. If we're moving on to one topic, I'd like to bring up. I guess I'll just be the one to bring it up because we were discussing this beforehand. So let's do this. Let's do this now. The charges of racism. I don't want to actually color the whole conversation with my own opinions on it yet, but I'm actually going to let you guys go first. So I'm going to run inside out of the list and start with Lupus.
Thanks.
What are your thoughts on the accusations of the twins being racist stereotypes?
Well, honestly, I don't see that much of an issue with it. And I know I probably pissed off a lot of people by saying that, but... At the same point, you could also look at Wheelie and say that he is the stereotypical 1930s wannabe a gangster Italian guy. And I didn't take any offense to that. But at the same time, I think they were trying to make characters that were... people could connect to in that kind of MTV gangsta wannabe... stereotype that people in urban cities might connect to.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if they died like they did with Jazz, then yeah, maybe they could sit there and say that it was, you know, complete racism. But, I mean, honestly, I thought the green one looked like Yoda at one scene, so. I don't know. I think people are going to throw up flags and look too deeply into things, and take offense. They might look for a reason to take offense for things, but and I can see their point, but at the same time, look at G1, how many other things have we seen that have, I mean, that are borderline.
Carbomia.
I mean, yes, Carbomia.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Outback. Or, you know,
or animated Blitzwing with his friggin', you know, missing chip in the front of the teeth thing, which, by the way, I did love, but still.
I mean, I don't know. That's my viewpoint.
All right. Let's move on to Seth, who just saw the movie today, in fact.
Yes. Just hours ago.
Oh.
I am not going to go so far as to say racist, but definitely stereotypes. And possibly negative stereotypes. Much like when I was pretty well sure that they were going to be like hillbilly southerner types. I think it's the same problem as them being urban, and I'm using air quotes. It's they could be the goofy slapstick characters and have those kind of lines where they're kind of rude and shoving each other around and not have to be like this really broad sort of unintelligent kind of, and by unintelligent, I don't mean the characters being unintelligent because that's okay to make them dumb if you want, but the way they portray the stereotype, I think, is unintelligent. I think it's just lazy in a way of creating a character to be like, it's not enough that they're comically goofballs, like Three Stooges kind of a thing, but to make them stand out more, they also have to be like, yo, what's up? I got a gold tooth and my tooths click together when I talk. And it's like, it's just, and we see that with other characters in these movies too. Like, it was kind of the same deal with Jazz. Like, it wasn't enough for Jazz to be Jazz. He had to be this extreme caricature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and kind of same thing with Jetfire. Like, but nobody's going to get upset that he's like Scottish and, oh, it's racist that he was Scottish. But, it just seems like it's too basic. Like, it's harder to make a character interesting on their own merits than it is to make them some crazy stereotype. And I don't know.
Although
I wanted to like them. They had funny lines, but it just bums me out that they had to take this easy road.
The question I'd actually want to pose directly would be, would you say that characters like, because this is my own viewpoint, that characters like Skids, Mudflap, Wheelie, and Jetfire were a lot more like cartoon characters than they were film characters?
Yeah, they were much more like cartoon characters, but I don't know if you would have been able to get away with Skids and Mudflap being like that in a modern cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would have, like, say, Cartoon Network being too nervous about offending somebody's sensibilities to let something like that through.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know. I don't think it's so bad that some people are making it out to be. I definitely would not go so far as to say that I felt that it was racist. My problem with it is more just, it seems lazy and easy.
Mm-hmm.
Than, like, oh my god, I'm making fun of black people. I don't think that was the intent. If I thought that was the intent, then I'd be like, yeah, this is crap. But I don't believe Michael Bay was like, oh, I'm going to stick it to the black folk this time. They're ooh, I'm going to show them. that was not the intent.
Gotcha.
I can see him wringing his hands like a really bad villain.
In his hands, stroking his mustache that's not there. Omegas, what's your...
tapping his fingertips together.
What's your take, Omegas, on the racism charges?
I'm kind of in the same boat in that I wouldn't call it racist. Stereotype, yes. Racist, no. And I'm also in the same boat. It's very, very lowbrow humor. It's very... easy humor to get away with, which I'm really not a fan of. I mean, yeah, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of talent to write a character that's funny and interesting and unique, and it's very simple to create something that's very stereotypical. But I kind of went in with this with the mindset, these are younger Autobots or kid appeal types. Of course they are. So I'm also viewing them as, every other kid I saw in high school that thought, oh, well, this is so cool, I'll emulate this. They're just, they don't know. Now, I wish I would have had, one scene where, they don't know any better. They just think that's cool, so we just let them do whatever. And yeah. They don't even do that.
Well, their whole character go ahead.
Yeah. Just between all the slamming around and just general goofing off that they do, even when they were still the ice cream truck, which amazed me that they actually had a scene as the ice cream truck. it just really kind of... I wish they had some kind of explanation. Just anything. Just say it one line. Do you know those two are kind of... they just think it's cool. We just let them do whatever. And, just at least explain, why are you tolerating this? Why, not only their behavior, but just, why they are just acting so stupid during a battle. Mm-hmm. Just tell me they're kids, they don't know any better, and I'm happy.
let's move along. Gog Dog, your thoughts on it?
I pretty much agree for the most part with what everybody else has said so far. The thing is, though, is in a lot of ways, it just seems to me like the people who are decrying this as racism are actually in a much bigger light. They're the ones committing quote unquote racism themselves, because all they're doing is they're making fun of a subculture in America. And I know I don't mean to steal any of Vangelis's thunder, and I'm sure he'll elaborate on his own opinions. Yeah, because we did talk about this a little bit before we started recording, but since he calls on me, and otherwise I won't have anything else to say because I agree with him completely. But they're making fun of a subculture, and that subculture in 21st century America has nothing to do with race. There are just as many white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, Asian kids in America that are part of this subculture, regardless of where they come from. And for the people who are decrying this as racism, they're basically the ones identifying that subculture with the black youth, saying that, oh, well, you're making fun of black kids. Really? Because I know just as many white kids or more that act that way. And for them to just jump on the bandwagon and say that it's racist against blacks, well, what country do you live in? Because I live in a country where it's pretty much equally all the same nowadays. At least it seems like that to me, where I went to school and where I live and the people that I see and the homes that I go in when I'm working. So, I don't know. It almost seems to me like people are getting really defensive over something. And in effect, they're the ones propagating a stereotype that, to me, doesn't really seem, to exist. The robots are raceless. There's no race. They're Cybertronian. So, in fact, it almost mimics the way that Earth is today. You have a race of people, and then you have subcultures within that. And the twins, being young, they decided to subscribe to this subculture. I guarantee you, they weren't like that before they came to Earth. Did anybody think of that? If they're from a different planet, they probably didn't have, this hip-hop subculture accent and tendencies like gold teeth and all that stuff before they came to Earth. It's something that they saw and they liked and they incorporated in themselves when they blended in on Earth and spent time here.
Yeah,
so,
but Bays are Nazis.
It's not like they're born as black robots and they say, oh, well, we're black robots, so on Earth this is how the blacks act, so we have to act this way. That's ridiculous. In effect, they're basically living up to the stereotype that they're accusing of everybody else of doing.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, I'll go into it myself after Aaron goes, but yeah, that lot of those things I kind of share, and I really had to go around and talk to a lot of people to even get a better understanding of where this was all coming from, because for the longest time, I thought this was just about the gangsta thing, and like Gog Dog said, I, in fact, the only people I've ever met who acted like that were of different ethnicities than those that are being proclaimed as being oppressed by those characters, is the best way I can put it. But Aaron, what are your thoughts on the racism?
My wife, who is of many and varied backgrounds, I asked her, you know, straight up after the film, since I'd seen it once already, did you find the Autobot twins racist? And she looked at me, kind of cocked her head, like they're racist? Or, you know, because just the thought of the way that they were acting really wasn't portraying any race. It was portraying stupidity. I mean, even though we don't really do the whole lot of reading thing. You know, that wasn't a black thing or a white thing. It was, it was a ghetto rat thing or a hillbilly. And I've met white ghetto rats and I've met black hillbillies. You know, it's not a color thing. It's a undereducated type of just.
Yeah, but it is, but at the same,
I'm dumb and proud to be dumb type of mentality.
Yeah, but the problem with the language is, and this is something that has been so misconstrued by seemingly 95% of the reviewers who have seen this movie. The twins look at the language, they identify it as the language of the primes. They can look at the language and tell what language it is. No other character in the entire movie besides Jetfire and the Fallen can read that language. That's the entire reason why they're looking for Jetfire, is to translate that. So the fact that they can't speak this language, everybody's saying, oh, well, they're racist. No, they're like everyone else in the entire movie. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Maybe they're understanding that comment to say that they can't read at all, but the fact that they can look at the language and say, oh, that's the language of the primes, that actually shows a small degree of intelligence to me. I mean, if you can look if I can look at Portuguese and say, oh, well, that's Portuguese, I can't read it, but I can understand what language it is. Come on.
Yeah, but it's how they say they can't read the language, not, oh, that's the language of the primes and only, like, someone that's that old could read it. No, the way that Skids says it is, oh, we ain't never done much reading. And it's like, No, that's playing into the stereotype.
It just seemed to me like that, like I said, it was the kind of people that are not intelligent and are almost proud of the fact that they're not intelligent, not any sort of race, creed, or color. It's just, hey, I'm kind of stupid and I'm cool with that type of thing. And that's the same, I mean, even with the one line that costs comedy and it's ass kicking, it's supposed to hurt.
Yes.
Type of thing. You know, some of those comments are, you know, I mean, they made for good comedy, but I don't see where the fire and vitriol of racism is coming in. That's the thing that confused me more than anything, because I heard, I think it was my first viewing, where somebody said something along those lines too. Well, they were obviously this, and it's like, well, no, they weren't. You want to see them as this, so that's what they're becoming to you. It is kind of what it seemed to me to quite a few people that have said that. It's like, well, no, I want to see some racism in here, so, well, hey, there's a place that can be racist.
Yeah, to deliver my own viewpoint on it, it's generally, when I watch them, now, here's the thing, as I said, I see gangsta and wannabe gangsta in particular as a lifestyle, and I see it also as something I find hilarious. It's always been one of my most chuckle-inducing things, is someone who stands around in the corner, clearly out of their element, going like, so, what's up? I wanted a top dollar bag of pants, and I got a nice big piece of steak for dinner tonight! And, you know, just like being a complete imbecile on the corner of the street kind of thing. And I find that hilarious. But, the only thing on this racism thing that's been in any way made into something I can see as palpable is a friend of mine told me they have big ears. And I had to actually have a lengthy explanation told to me of exactly what that means. And honestly, I see the big ears as big antenna, so I still don't really agree with that. And I see the gold tooth, again, as a thing that's not really a racial tendency. But at the end of the day, it's also, I'm very willing to admit that, number one, I've been looking at these robot designs in leaks and whatnot over the last year, so they've just grown on me, and I everything about them just feels like characteristics of those designs. And number two, perhaps I'm just not wholly sensitive because it seems that no one's bringing up the Nazi scientist doctor wearing 16 monocles as a potential racially insensitive thing. But then again, as we all know, it's perfectly fine to make fun of the Germans. That's what I've learned as a half-German child in elementary school. So I'll just throw that one out there to try and make some people feel tremendously uncomfortable! Yeah, so I wanted just to tackle that topic only because it seems to be one of the biggest talking points of the movie that I feel a lot of wasted energy is going into, to be perfectly honest. That said, we also just talked about it for like 20 minutes. But, yeah, let's continue on with some non-racially sensitive thingamadoos. I don't know, let's run through the list one more time in that same order. Aaron, have you got anything else you'd like to bring up?
I'll go down my many people's list here. Sideswipe, badass. The his kind of introduction of splitting sideways in half was cool, and then he just ends up becoming a background guy.
Damn, I'm good.
Yeah. That and then...
Not good enough to make it past the scene.
It just seemed like some of them were just getting an introduction to disappear. I mean, well, the RCs got... I mean, they were there a lot until that last battle scene where two of them become red shirts. Like, oh, hey, come on, boom, boom! Oh, well, okay. What was the point to have three of them when you could have just had one and not have two blown up? But
To have them combine and then get that sequence cut out of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, oddly enough, this actually takes me into a bit of info that I've noticed. This is something I actually sussed out over Twitter. I don't mean to steer us off course for a sec, but there were a lot of characters who I feel could have been in the movie more, and I think a lot of people are, through that, saying they felt the twins were in the movie too much. But honestly, I found the twins weren't really actually in the movie all that much. I'm thinking it's more a case of attributing the absence of all these other characters to the twins getting a decent amount of screen time. And to be honest, I felt it was more like, I'd like to see this much of the twins and also this much of Sideswipe and RC and Ironhide and Ratchet.
The one that kind of confused me overall was Volt.
Well, he was
because
written in at the last minute.
I mean, Jolt. Because Jolt. We kept hearing... Yeah. Well, we kept hearing about Volt and seeing Volt and all this stuff, and then he
Jolt.
Ends up just...
Jolt.
Or, yeah, Jolt
the Volt.
It's their fault for making it a rhyme scheme. It's like he shows up and he's kind of background and you kind of see his hands do a cool glowy thing when they all get surrounded by the military when the presidential appointee guy shows up. And then you don't see anything about him until he's transferring energy and parts or something between Jetfire and Prime, and then that's it. It's like, okay, well, I understand that you wanted to get the car in there, but did we even really see any good car shots of him?
No.
We saw a little bit in one drive thing, and then and that's it. It's like, well, if he's in there to feature, then why don't you have at least one, you know, one of those highway scenes have a good kind of pan around shot? But I don't know. That was
yeah. Well,
that
wasn't
was
the story that GM asked for the Volt to be put in kind of at the last minute, and he was kind of shoehorned in at the end. But but even with that, I was also disappointed. I was really looking forward to seeing what they were going to do with Jolt, and they really didn't do anything.
Yeah. I wanted a whip fight. Him and a rampage would have been awesome.
Absolutely would have wanted that.
Like a game of slaps. It's like a game of slaps. They just take turns one at a time. All right, give me a minute. Pap. All right. Hold on.
Well, you know, Jolt did do something because he, out of nowhere, was called upon by name by Ratchet to resurrect Optimus Prime and combine him to Jetfire, which has led me to see Jolt as this mythical wandering Autobot Jesus who, like, just kind of shows up and performs miracles, then wanders back into the desert.
Yeesh. Yeah, because Ratchet did so much in this movie, too.
He called upon Jolt.
Yeah. You have to look summoned, closely, Jolt's wearing sandals.
He summoned Autobot Jesus.
I thought that was Bumblebee to go back and forth across the Red Sea from Egypt to Jordan.
Yeah, folks, we broke out a map while we were talking and took a look at some geography, and apparently Bumblebee can drive on water.
Well, I assume he got the canceled Hydro Dive armor from the last Bumblebee.
You see, guys, if we can come up with these explanations, surely all of you can. Jolt was... I was surprised that they built a full robot model for him, considering all the times he showed up. I mean, when he was... I loved it when I spotted him in the military scene, and you could hear his whips making all these crackling noises, and I was like, oh, he's gonna pwn him some military. And he just kind of, like, stands there going, like, I'm Jolt. I'll turn your water into wine. I'm looking forward to the toy now, though, because I've crafted this mythology around him, but, That's mostly just me.
Yeah, well,
he's going to be glowing when you get to the toy store.
Glowing.
Yeah,
long
just
hair.
How little we got of Jolt and how little we got of Sideways were two of my bigger disappointments.
Oh, Sideways got screwed. And
all
the TV trailers spoiled what happened to him too. That's one of the money shots in the trailers. Look, it's the Audi getting cleft in twine, and I was like, Sideways.
Yeah. But it was a money shot in the first 10 minutes, which makes it fair game.
Yeah, I guess.
See, his whole lifespan plays out in those commercials.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just about every shot of him is either in a commercial or the trailer. I think the only thing that we hadn't seen of him before was when his lights turn on and he drives away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I thought he was actually Sideswipe at first in that scene, only because it's two silver cars and I'm... You know, not a car guy, not like Aaron. And,
are you saying that all silver cars are just alike?
I am, in fact, insensitive.
Are you saying racist? No, are you saying all white people are car lovers?
Yes.
Christ almighty.
All white people are car lovers, and all silver cars are exactly the same. I'm adjusting my monocle now, because I'm clearly German. Yeah, poor Jolt. He's not even in the video game. Gog, have you got another point you'd like to bring up?
Ooh, I got a big one, but
ooh,
I'll
do it.
I'll put. Should I drop the big one, or do you want me to wait and do a little
do
one
it.
Now and come to the big one towards the end?
Drop it.
All right. Here's the deal. Let me get hunkered down here.
It better be big after all that build-up. Better be big.
Well, for you, nothing can ever live up to your expectations, Seth.
No, of course not. Especially you.
Oh!
Oh,
Jolt!
I'm
going
to take off my microphone and go home. But,
Jolt!
All right. I've noticed a theme, and a lot of this has been stuff that's kind of come out towards the... right before the movie had ended, or... No, I mean... premiered, but actually it was after it premiered in like the UK and Japan. And a lot of it is based on comments from Bay, and a lot of it is based on comments from Orsi, posting actually on TFW. And I've noticed a lot of things, and there seems to be kind of a theme in the production of the movie. And that theme revolves around the writers versus the director. We've seen, or we heard a lot of comments about Orsi, saying how it was going to be kind of a darker movie. They had based the movie, or at least the theme of when they were writing the movie, on sequels that they liked as kids. And they had, you know, that came bigger, badder, but, you know, darker and more ominous, more at stake. They mentioned Empire Strikes Back as an example several times. They promised more of the mythology and that sort of thing. And if you go and if you read a lot of Orsi's comments, you know, like one member on TFW had asked Orsi, he was asking about Soundwave's voice, is how the whole conversation started. Mm-hmm. And Orsi had said that him and Kurtzman fought. They fought Bay to include that because they knew it was something that the fans were going to love, and Bay pretty much refused. Final word was with him, and he said no, and Orsi said that he thinks Bay's reason for that was that he thought the audience would find it too hard to understand. And I'm not going to latch on to that. It wasn't the voice I ended up liking it. I would have liked the vocoder, whatever. It's not really the point. The point is then someone had replied to Orsi with that comment saying, well, it seems like a lot of the theme that I'm catching is you guys fought for a lot of things with Bay, and, you know, such as more screen time for Sideswipe and some of these other characters, whereas Bay, you know, pretty much insisted on the inclusion, the creation and the inclusion of the twins, and it seems like this is kind of a theme. And Orsi replied with a winky smile. And then you see other things, like, RC. You know, the writers created RC, they wrote her into the movie. And then you get Bay's comment, not too long ago, maybe a month or two ago, of how, oh, I didn't like RC, so I killed her. And I'm connecting my own dots, and this may be just something that I see, and, so I'm going to present this as objectively as possible and then give my opinion more towards the end. But the it really seems like there was kind of like a little war to – not maybe not even a war. That's an inappropriate term. But there was a struggle, even maybe if minor, between the writers to have their vision of the film versus what Bay decided was going to be his version of the film. And I think, because to me at least, a lot of the mythological parts of the movie were some of the most that I was looking forward to. I was really looking forward to seeing the history of the Primes and that sort of thing, to see the Fallen just come out as a complete, you know, badass. It was these darker elements that, and I've expressed that before, that I was really looking forward to. I know that the writers are capable. We've seen some of their other work. I'm personally... a big fan of Mission Impossible 3. I thought they did a great job with that. Star Trek, another one. By no means are these writers perfect. No, by no means are they messianic. Star Trek, the script was flawed. The difference between Star Trek and Revenge of the Fallen, I think, not to really interject my opinion into it, but I guess that's unavoidable. But it just seemed to me Star Trek flowed much better, and it just seems to me, because it's basically the same writers, and it just seems to me like with Kurtzman and Orsi working with J.J. Abrams, they just work so much cohesively more as a team, and I think the script, at least from an audience point of view, was much more loved, regardless of its flaws, which were recognized. Whereas with Revenge of the Fallen, you really have a lot of sloppy stuff going on. A lot of that may be editing. A lot of that is direct inclusion from the director. And it just seems to me like, I wonder what would have happened, because we see, like, with Orsi and Kurtzman working with Abrams, like, how would the Revenge of the Fallen script have played out with a completely different director, say, you know, even J.J. Abrams, who they tend to work well with. Because, again, J.J. Abrams directed Mission Impossible 3, which I thought was a pretty brilliant movie. That ended up pretty good, pretty well in the end. It just really makes me... Holocausting up a... Yeah, okay. forgive me. Yeah. But it just seems to me like a lot of the awkward moments in the movie, and again, this is my opinion, like, I agree with what Seth said earlier. I was prepared for twins to just be completely just goofy off the wall. But at the same time, I would have liked to have seen, I mean, and maybe Vangelis is right in that the twins didn't take up a huge amount of screen time, but you have to think of this. The original plan for the script was not to have the twins at all. If it wasn't for the twins, we would have gotten more Sideswipe and those type of characters in. And to the, I don't know, it just seems like for the people who were looking for the more serious tone of the movie and how some of the humor just didn't really play out. And this isn't going to be all Bay's fault, I understand that. But it just seems like... The kind of the struggle between the desires of the of the writer versus the struggles of the director made a lot of the film kind of sloppy, and in my opinion, kind of made the darker elements of the movie in a way pushed to the side, because I really got the impression that they did not care as passionately about those aspects of the film as the writers did. And again, and we know he took direct control of the movie. As far as just taking parts of the script he didn't like, even entire characters, and saying, oh, I don't like that, let's kill him. And so, I want to hear what you guys think about that.
Actually, that is in a roundabout way something I've told some other people about the movie, which is that this film was very clearly created by committee, and there were a lot of hands in the pot. And if you compare Star Trek in this film, you can really see how that... Like, I would just say that I don't think there is any writer out there whose work would go unaffected by a committee film. But at the same time, this is a toy commercial film, and look at where comic book films were when they were new.
But I don't think it has to be that, because...
Well, it doesn't have to be, but it's...
Because it's the situation. It is, but it's only a matter of, say, the director. And I'm not trying to be anti-Bay. I'm just talking about his relationship with the writers. If you had had another director on it, and I'm just using JJ because he has worked with Orson Kurtzman in the past on more than one occasion. If you had had a different director, that's the only difference between those films and this film. In some ways, I understand you still have the producers, you know, like D. Bonaventure or whatever, who some parties are going to be involved that weren't involved in the other films, but I think a lot of it too is Bay's directing style, and it just seemed to me like a lot of the content in the movie that the writers very much took seriously was treated very sloppily and even maybe pushed aside because of what the writer or what the director wanted to include and the things that he took seriously. And to me, I'm just a little disappointed by that because, like I said, those darker elements and not even darker, but just the more mythological and those things, I think that on the script, and I think this is the best way that I can put it. If you were to read the script, maybe in a novel form, like not the prequel novel, because I think even those didn't have the full... If you were to have a novelization of this written by the writers, I think it would be a much more cohesive story than what we got in the film. And I think if you compared maybe the script for Star Trek compared to what we actually got in the film, you would have the movie and the film or in the script would have actually been a lot closer together. But I think because of the relationship between the writers and the director, that the end result from script to film is a completely different thing than what was first imagined by the writers. And again, this isn't the writer's film. The writers don't own this, but I think that they were going in the right direction, and a lot of things were changed. Maybe not necessarily for the worse, but just to make it just maybe a little less cohesive and sloppy.
Oddly enough, the epilogue to this little story of mine is that I actually mentioned that Bay might have almost been a positive force in that his abrasive personality more or less seemed to shut the producers out of the creative process, which, you know, it puts things in two different directions, but I think it would, with a different director, there would have been a higher chance of producer meddling, whereas with Bay, at least, everything kind of flows at least into him and then the writer, so it's just two people at odds instead of, like, 8 or 12. But, no, it is interesting, although at the same time, I still don't really know what other director I would see as a plausible director for this right now. I'd need to go looking through some resumes of work, and I need to see specifically how people have worked with full CG sequences. Star Trek had quite a few, but nonetheless, I'm actually still not sure who else I would want on directing this right now, aside from perhaps Guillermo, because he likes his robot gears.
But yeah.
I think Seth wanted to drop some thoughts in.
Yeah. I think, like, this sort of thing probably happens all the time in movies, and it's really only something that we are aware of happening because Bob Orsi in particular has been so in contact with the community, answering questions on a multitude of message boards. A lot of times... Like, a script will be bought from a writer, and then they have nothing to say about it after that. Like, you could look at Natural Born Killers as an example. That was written by Quentin Tarantino before anybody knew who Quentin Tarantino was, and just left in a drawer until post Pulp Fiction, when all of a sudden now that dude is the king of Hollywood, and the studio goes digging around in their drawer and goes, "Oh crap, we got a Tarantino script," and then passes it off to Oliver Stone, and Tarantino has no other dealings with that movie. And at least for me, like, I could watch that movie and I see Tarantino in it and think, wow, this could have been so much greater if Tarantino directed it himself, because I don't think Oliver Stone handled it properly. And that's probably a lot of kind of the same situation. And it's unfortunate, but it's one of those things where, you know, you can't really do much about it. And I'm just worried that it's going to lead to Orson Kurtzman not coming back for number three. Because when the first movie came out and they were starting to get asked a lot, are you going to write the sequel? They sort of left themselves an out of, well, we would like to, but, you know, nobody's asked us to do it and we don't have an idea yet. So if everything comes together, we totally will. And now I've been seeing, like, Orson Kurtzman comment of, yeah, we don't know. Like, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, I think they've been a little defensive too towards the end, because they're catching a lot of flack, especially for the twins and stuff. And they're kind of, while they're not coming out and actually saying, like, it wasn't us, that was Bay, I mean, they're kind of dropping hints like, look, you know, we were doing what we were told. And I think that they're kind of on the defensive because they don't want to take responsibility for something that they were basically forced to include.
And that's why
and with the success of Star Trek and Fringe, I have to imagine they have a lot more cachet now in Hollywood. They very well may be in a position now where they can say, well, you know what, we don't need to work with somebody we don't like, and we'd much rather write on a movie with a director that's going to be more open and a partner to us than just saying, oh, here's our script, and then not having any further involvement.
Oh, definitely, and that's where my point was coming in about the toy commercial film and the comic book film, is I think that it's all about the levels of respect that a film is treated with, and as someone who despises genres on the whole for shoehorning films and music, etc., I think that toy commercial films, seeing how right now I can only think of three, that being Transformers 1 and 2 and G.I. Joe, as films based on a toy property, I think that they could become something more, and something one could take seriously, and something on the level of current comic book films' potential in a couple years. But right now, it feels like they're going through the same learning curves that the comic book films of a lot of the 90s went through.
It with video game movies, too.
They
haven't figured out how to do toys or video games yet.
And that's not to say that I think the Transformers movies are complete crap, because I don't. And I think that the movies that we have gotten are a whole lot better than what we could have. And I'm not saying that at all. And I know none of you guys think that. I just want to say that for the record. I'm just saying that it could be better, and I'm just throwing this out here.
We're all waiting for that renaissance to hit. Like, with comic book movies, I always think of that renaissance as being Spider-Man 1, Hellboy, and Blade, as being like kind of like the trinity of movies that collectively brought comic book movies to a sense where they felt they could be taken seriously, and then something like Batman Begins or The Dark Knight could be made. So that's what I'm holding out for. I don't think G.I. Joe's going to do it. I may as well just say it right now. But, you know, somewhere down the road, it would be nice if a Transformers sequel did it, but I'd say just keep your hopes up that it happens sometime, and don't expect us to be on the other end of that renaissance quite yet. This is not to any of you guys, just to the listenership in general. That's just my view on it, is like, we're on one end of the renaissance. We've seen this cycle in many other things, and as Seth said, you can also see video game movies going through the same thing. And hopefully someday they'll finish that cycle the same way comic book movies did, and I can stop referring to them by these kind of generalizations, because I really hate doing it! So after that epic topic, let's move along and get Lupus to drop us something topic-wise.
Wow, well, now I know where Transformer babies come from, and we know that they have female Transformers, and they didn't do it in such a way that you're going to have people screaming, like, obscene, weird things. It's just, they're there, it can be accepted, or you can just say that they're crossdressers, or they're drones, you know. But it's done in such a way that there isn't any prelude or, you know, backstory or great detail into as why. It's just, they're accepted, they're there, bam, let's move on.
Trans from sex.
See, we didn't need to go there.
Oh, God.
But speaking of sex, what was with all the sex in the movie? Like, there was a couple jokes in the first movie, but this totally pushed the envelope.
Because dogs are frisky.
Apparently. But, so God, I apparently. So,
ew.
I don't know if anyone's actually gone looking for a wheelie since the movie's come out.
That was the sound of mine.
I know. Yikes. What are you doing to that microphone?
Oh,
but I went to a couple Toys R Us and Walmarts today, and they had all Wave 2 out, but all the wheelies were gone. Completely picked clean. So,
I'm just saying,
kudos.
Looking at my wheelie on a child, he would be life-size humping your leg.
Ugh.
He's doing it to mine right now. Yeah, I don't know. Leg humping is funny, is, I think, the train of thought. Whether or not that's actually true is up to the individual. But I, for one, am able to overlook it so long as it only happens once or twice. That's my my view on leg humping.
Am I right in thinking that the other dog's name was Bone Crusher?
But he was on the bottom. That would be so wrong. Bone Crusher's on the top. Bone Crusher's on the top where it matters. I don't know. The sex personally didn't really bother me all that much. I kind of just chalked it up to the same place as the balls and the farts.
Oh, God.
They were things that just kind of happened very briefly.
No.
Oh, did you listen to that podcast I was talking about?
I actually haven't yet, but I did bump the thread like 3 times.
Yeah, the balls are they are brought up and discussed, and the people responsible are named. So for people who don't know what I'm talking about, there's a local radio station. I'll just try to make this real quick. A local radio station, their morning show has a podcast. It's called the Sarah and Vinny Secret Show. If you go to RadioAlice.com, you can find it. There's an episode just recently where they had one of the animators from ILM come in, and they talk about Star Wars and Transformers and the fan sites and our effect on how the movies came out and all kinds of really cool, interesting stuff, like Devastator's balls.
Excellent.
Jeez. That made me feel so bad. That made me feel so bad for John Turturro. Because he gets so humiliated in all the movies. I mean, it's not enough that he's de-pantsed in the first movie. He gets peed on. Then the second movie, he's in a thong. And then his big climax at the end is getting to climb a pyramid to look at Devastator's constructicles.
I'm curious, Omegas, how you feel about that in relation to the filmmaking process, perhaps even the committee filmmaking process of a topic or two ago.
thank you. I'm glad you asked. That was really my biggest problem with the movie was how much interjected humor, how many things led up just for a punchline. It felt I could go with how fast the story was going, I could go with how many different places they were hopping, but what disjointed the movie for me was how many jokes were thrown in. Like, oh, the mom bought marijuana brownies. Just totally nowhere.
Not brownies!
I can't believe that she would be that stupid.
Well, Also, just as a denizen of BC, where we do have BC Superweed, which I have found out is in fact ranked higher than the Taliban on the U.S. threat list, a lot of us here in BC are annoyed because that's not what pot brownies do to you, damn it. And we feel that pot has been misrepresented, and that did lead to some points of offense in the BC audience.
Yeah, I really liked the mom character. I thought she was great in the first movie. I thought she had some really good moments in this movie, too. But, yeah, the whole marijuana brownie thing was like, you're wrecking this character for me.
It almost seems like she could have, or both of them could have disappeared, the parents, right after they dropped Sam off. And yeah. It wouldn't have had much of an effect until, you know, see him in Paris, and then the kidnap, and then, you know, show up again at the end. And the whole pot brownie, my son just popped his cherry, all that stuff could have gone away, cut 4 or 5 minutes out of the film, or allowed 4 or 5 minutes for something else.
Well, again, to put my BC rage hat on, you know, what would have vindicated that whole scene is if, by damn it, they said that pot brownie actually had been laced with the crystal meth, because that happens, you know, and other hallucinogens. So... here in BC, we take our pot accuracy seriously, and by damn it, we feel like we've been oppressed almost even on an ethnic level, as BC people.
Man, I feel the same way about that. It's just like the whole brownie scene, I was just like, oh, this is so unneeded. You don't have to have the mom run out and just tackle teenagers. I mean,
yeah,
reefer madness.
And some of the humor, like, and I don't think... That was one of my complaints about the first movie, was just some of the humor was just so out of place. Like, take in the first movie, the scene with Sam with the cop. He's like, oh, you looking at my piece? It's funny when you have subtle things like that interjected, but when you just play it so over the top and unrealistically, it's, you know, in if you have a movie where the humor is just like that throughout. And I guess maybe that's what they were going for in here, but I just don't think it worked. There was one example that I wish I could think of, and I can't remember what it was, but there was this one scene where the Decepticons were just doing something just evil, and the whole scene was just menacing, and you're just like, man, what's going on here? Then they cut away, and then... now that I think about it, I think it was when Soundwave was hacking the satellites and the Fallen was broadcasting his message on the screens. You have this sense where they're like, Megatron's like, all right, it's on now. We're going to reveal ourselves to the world. And then, you know, they're showing it and everybody's looking at the screens like, what's going on? Then it cuts to the mom and then she just says something just completely stupid. And then
it must have been the wrong number.
There was a couple of moments like that, though, where the humor was just, it's like, man, it just takes you out of the moment. It's if you're trying to set this eerie... mood of dread and despair. Don't just drop some stupid one-liner on me and make me laugh and then expect me to go right back into
that little bit there. Did you catch what was being said on the phone? Because I paid special attention on my second
viewing. Well, that might be a bad example. That was just the one that came to my mind. And I've only seen the movie once. So I wanted to see it again, but I haven't had a chance. But there was more than one moment like that in the movie. That might have been a bad example.
I just know in that instance, the second time I listened to it, it sounded like Soundwave's voice, or maybe even the Fallen's voice, very garbled, bad cell phone connection, saying, "Where is the boy?"
Oh, it definitely was. It was a Decepticon.
She's like, "Yeah, okay, whatever," and hangs up. I don't think that was a comedy thing. I think that was either them trying to track her to wherever they are, or hey, maybe mom will say, "Oh yeah, he's."
That's what I liked. I liked the almost innocent levels of naivety the Decepticon showed briefly. Like maybe if we just call his mom, she'll tell us where he is.
Yeah, that's how I took it. I took it as Soundwave was, like, he specifically sought out her phone because they were trying to get a bead on them.
Well, they did, and then right after that they kidnapped him, so...
To Sam, sort of a thing.
Yeah, I was thinking that...
But going back to the where she was talking about, oh, my son got his cherry popped and I heard it through the wall and all that, I thought that was funny, like, her telling some co-eds that... And I thought it fit her character, considering the whole Sam's Happy Time scene from the first movie, how she sort of has, like, this... When it comes to sexuality issues, she has, like, no sense of boundary. But once it was the pot-fueled ravings of a lunatic woman, then it kind of spoiled what I thought could have been a funny little moment.
And that's not how pot works, damn it. I was going to say again. Mm-hmm. I know! Anyway, hey Seth, how would you like to bring up a point to talk about?
Okay. Well, we've been kind of negative for a while, and most of my points have been negative, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm part of the hater squad. So I'm going to bring up something that I really enjoyed. Maybe my favorite part of the movie was the Optimus Prime versus Megatron Starscream and Grindor fight in the woods.
Hell yeah.
I thought that scene was just awesome. You really got to see the camera pulled back. You really got a sense of the scale of these characters. And you just saw Prime fighting overwhelming odds like a champ.
Yeah.
And I just thought that whole sequence was just fantastic.
Definitely agreed. Definitely agreed. And it also gave us a glimpse into something I'm going to bring up when it comes around to me. But it was great, and I was kind of sad that I was hoping that the Egypt fights would match up and even go to higher levels of awesome than the forest fight, but I am kind of falling into the same train of thought a lot of other people are, which is that the forest fight scene was kind of the highlight of the movie for a lot of us, or at least action-wise. And it was pretty freaking cool. And it was pretty sick. Pretty
with the
intense.
Forest, the only human you had to worry about was Sam, and he was hiding or trying to hide the whole time. You get to Egypt, now you have the entire army, and they are part of the battle, so now you have to bring the scale back down to ground level kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that one interesting thing about that scene, and only having Sam as the one human character, was it just you just have this one little dude that looks like a squirrel running around between the legs of these giant robots. And it was a great example of how big of the action that's going on right now. I mean, you have Transformers ripping trees out and using them as swords. I mean, they're more like baseball bats, but it was I agree with Seth. I loved that scene so much, and Starscream getting his arm cut off. Ow, my arm! It reminded me a lot of Ow, my foot from the '86 movie, but because he basically said the same thing. But it was just like Seth said, I think a lot of the stuff we've been bringing up has been negative, but the action and the CG and the effort that ILM put into this movie is 100% beautiful, top notch. I absolutely love the special effects. It's one of those few special effects movies that you can actually just watch and just forget that you're watching, CG. It's like you can actually believe that these dudes are just duking it out in front of real people.
Yeah, there were only a handful of times in the movie where I thought like a CG model looked kind of fakey or out of place, like where maybe the colors didn't quite match up right with the background. But for like 98% of the movie, it's some of the most amazing CGI work I've ever seen. Just as not even the detail and complexity of the models, but just how well they fit the models into the real world backgrounds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. ILM, I think a lot of that goes to applause. I think a lot of that also goes to the fact it was a lot, like I've said a couple times before, a lot longer shots of stuff. We're not seeing an elbow and a knee cut away and then another shaky shot. It was, I mean, a lot of those fight scenes were good, longer things. You could see what was happening, so everything had a better feel to it than the old shaky cam of the first movie.
And throwing in those slow motions as well really helped, especially with, things like head getting ripped in half by two orange hooks, or unfortunate quadruped getting boned like a fish as his spine sprays green fluid everywhere.
Well, that was one of the funny things that my brother had to say, was he went the biology route in high school. He had like 3 or 4 semesters of biology. And he said, having dissected quite a few cats, there really is only one way to truly skin a cat, and Bumblebee did it just right. You grab the tail and you pull it off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If ILM doesn't get the Oscar for effects on this movie, then the fix is in. Like, the Academy has it out for Michael Bay or something, and ILM is an unfortunate bystander in the crossfire, but if they don't get the Oscar for this one...
Is there a Golden Compass 2 coming out? Because
there better not be.
No.
Or they're going to give it to Harry Potter, which is like close enough to Golden Compass, or it's going to be dumb if it doesn't win.
I have such a rant about the Golden Compass Oscar, but I'm going to prevent myself from letting it off here. Just if any listeners want it, remind me, and I'll do it some other time.
Future supplemental.
Such a rant. You should have. I wish we were doing the podcast when that happened. I friggin' called my buddy Jacob.
Calm down, calm down. You said you weren't going to go into it.
I'm not going to go into it. I'm just going to tell a story. I was on the phone for, I swear to God, like 30 minutes speaking in caps lock about the pure injustices and the biases behind why that guy got the Oscar and not someone, you know, not retiring that year. But, yes! Hey, Omegas, how'd you like to share a point with us?
Let's go over here for a second.
Golden Compass! Anyway, continue.
I love seeing the elements of Decepticon behavior in this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, actually getting a scene themselves this time around was actually really cool. I mean, we touched on it, talking about watching little, Decepti-fetuses springing out. But that was actually just like this really cool scene, and it reminded me of those old brooding, we're going to explain our whole plot for the kid audience scenes from the old cartoon. Mm-hmm. And it just, it gave you a little bit of development for Starscream, Megatron, and especially the Fallen being brand new.
And just a quick aside, that's kind of why I brought up the whole cartoony character thing, because that was actually a plus for me in this movie. I think it might just be from having watched animated, but having kind of cartoonier characters made me feel closer to the movie. And also things like that brooding scene, or the scene where Megatron kidnaps Sam, where he's delivering, like, you know, just villain dialogue, and it brought me closer to the movie, I found.
Well, this movie made me feel sorry for Starscream, because he's such kind of groveling toward Megatron, and Megatron is just so mean and brutal to him, like beating him with his own arm and stomping on his chest. It's like, I don't think Starscream deserves to be treated this way. Like, maybe if he just tried to shoot you in the back, but he didn't do that.
Yeah, I was just happy to see Starscream and the other Decepticons get any personality at all. It's just, that was the number one problem I had with the first movie, is the only Decepticon that had any real personality was, you had a little bit of Megatron, you had some Barricade, who had probably, besides Megatron, the only real speaking role in the whole movie as far as Decepticons go. And the Decepticon that stole the entire show in the first movie was Frenzy. I mean, that was basically it. Then all of a sudden, the 75% of the Decepticons show up at the end, speak a couple grunts and moans in Cybertronian, and then that's it. So all you have them is just as cannon fodder. This movie really addressed most of those issues. The enemies had a goal, had a plan, they had character development, they had scenes on their own where it was nothing but robots talking to other robots about robot stuff. And maybe it wasn't as much as, you know, what some people would have liked, but it was far and away a step up from what we got in the first movie. As far as Starscream goes, I liked him in this movie. A lot of people had complained that he was kind of just like, in the first movie he was a total badass, and in this one he was just a groveling weakling. I don't really agree with that. I mean, I think in the first one he was, the fact that Megatron came back and the first thing Megatron did is go up to Starscream and tell him that, you ain't in charge, buddy, and I'm not too happy about it. I think the rest of the movie he was kind of in fear of what was going to happen, and Megatron continuously reiterated the fact that he wasn't really happy about that situation. But
yeah,
I think that kind of easily. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, the groveling is a Starscream character trait we always get, but it's usually after he just tried to screw Megatron over.
Right.
And by saying I felt sorry for Starscream in this movie, in that we never saw him try to screw Megatron over, and Megatron was just always just abusive toward him for, it seemed to me, like, no real reason.
Well, he wasn't really abusive to him in the first one. He just made the comment that you've let me down again.
No,
so
I meant this one. Maybe
that was a hint. Right, but I'm saying, Megatron puts his foot down in the beginning as soon as he's revived, saying, like, you know, there is no rule but mine. And it basically, he was established in territory, and I think from that point on, Starscream was basically watching his back. So
yeah,
I don't know. That was just how I took
him in that. Yeah, I almost expected him in that last scene for Starscream to back up and pop him with a missile, just you know, because he's still torn up from the battle. Yeah, I almost expect him to take advantage of that.
Yeah, or at least try to run away without Megatron and leave Megatron to fend for himself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, he kind of did. He told Megatron, he's like, in the end, he's like, look, I'm leaving. You can come with me or not. Because he told Megatron, he said, you know, I don't mean to call you a coward, but sometimes the cowardly approach lets you live to fight another day or whatever he said. I don't remember it word for word. But then Starscream just turns around and flies off. Then Megatron kind of looks and he's like, all right. And he goes off behind him, but Starscream is basically like, I'm leaving, and you can leave too, but I'm out of here, because if not, we're both going to die.
I think my favorite part was... my favorite part, I think, was the resurrection scene, where they go, well, we need a spark, and they just randomly clobber someone that came down with them.
We need pots!
Well, yeah, but...
take the small one! I'm jamming!
But when they go back up, it's one more than what went down.
Yeah.
What was it? 4 signals go down and then 6 come up or something like that? I forget.
That's because...
The doctor!
They killed... Okay, so they went down with 4 and they came up with 6 and they killed one. So there were 3 plus 3, Megatron, Blackout, and Bone Crusher! There we go. I solved the movie's big crazy thing.
Oh.
Yeah, that scene was another example... in my opinion, of the sloppy editing, because the doctor says, we need parts, kill the little one, then you see him tearing the little one apart, then they cut to now Megatron's completely reassembled in his new form with his tank feet, because when they use the Allspark fragment on him, and he sort of kicks his feet up from the zap, you see they're the tank feet. Mm-hmm. And so it was just another, like, okay, well, we're not going to bother showing you them using the parts, just cut, done. And another case where the sense of time just disappears.
Yeah, and then Megatron flies, and then all of a sudden he's like on Saturn's moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one really, really took me out of it. I was like, oh, for crying out loud, guys. And then I was going like, you know, not only that, but the average theater-going audience, they don't even know why he's going to Saturn's moon.
Yeah.
That gave me just so many General Grievous flashbacks.
Yeah. But and one last thing about that whole scene at the end when Megatron and Starscream escape, and again, going to what Seth said about the fact that Megatron was treating Starscream so badly, I laughed out loud when Megatron got his face half blown off, and the very first thing he says is, Starscream!
Yes! That was awesome!
Yeah. It's like, yeah, who are you calling for now?
And I love that also because I was afraid they'd just killed off Megatron again, and I was so happy they didn't.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I was. That was definitely. That was definitely. Yeah, that was a huge plus for me that they let him escape and leave it open for the next one.
It's not like in the movie verse that death is really that much of a career hindrance anymore. I mean, we had 4 resurrections in this movie alone.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you have to first find the glittery fairy dust and keep it in a sock. Or, you know, kill the small one.
Or you have to find a piece of an Allspark.
That's right. Or you have to be Bone Crusher's, like, little brother, or whoever that was supposed to... No, that was Bone Crusher, if you ask me. That was Bone Crusher. Right.
Or you have to die and go to Autobot Heaven.
That's right, even if you're a human.
Even if you're a human.
But as far as Bone Crusher being there, the multiple Constructicons in each form, I just took that, and Grindor being, you know, that looks like Blackout. I think it's the movie trying to be true to the toys in that they are honoring the tradition of repaints. And when the color scheme is exactly the same, then they were probably a packaging variant.
Well, for me, it was just like when the Blackout Grindor helicopter appeared, there was also this dark chord in the music, and I was just waiting for Sam to go like, oh my god, it's Blackout, how's that possible? And then the doctor would be all like, well, you see, I put him back together using my special Nazi powers.
But yeah, I just like the idea that it was Bone Crusher only because the moment Prime got back up, Bone Crusher just fled the entire battle because he remembered.
So, oh snap!
Which if we're gonna come around to me again, that can bring up my point I wanted to bring up, which is that this went in two ways. For one, I thought it was awesome that Prime was in this movie just kicking ass like a homicidal maniac and, you know, just dealing it out left and right. At the same time, I was also very perturbed by the fact that Prime was a homicidal maniac, ripping heads in half, declaring, "Give me your face," before ripping the villain's face off, and the faceless, skeletal, baby-like, screaming, fallen face turns and fills the screen as he goes, "Oh my god, my face!" I'm not at the point where I'm not, like, you know, on the whole hyperbole side, like, oh my god, they ruined Prime forever. I don't think that's the case at all. I just found it, it was actually immersion-breaking at times how, as I like saying, how homicidal Optimus Prime is in the movie-verse. I actually liken him to another homicidal maniac that a lot of us look up to as a hero, that being Obi-Wan Kenobi. him and Optimus Prime both share a similar fetish, that being a specific biology murder fetish. Prime clearly likes to destroy faces and heads, whereas Obi-Wan Kenobi likes to lop off hands and arms. So, you know, maybe it's just a thing I don't get, being a Canadian.
Well, Prime did yank off Starscream's arm.
He chopped it off, and he freaking... I was just waiting, like, after I saw the movie, I thought to myself, wouldn't it have been funnier if in that opening scene when Demolishor was all like, "The fallen will rise again," Prime just cuts him off, goes like, "Give me your face," and you just kind of pan away, and you hear these horrific screams as Demolisher's face is torn apart layer by layer as he's alive the entire time until Prime, like, plucks his cortex out of his brain and eats it. And
Wait, when did Prime become Siler?
I don't know, the dude, even the blackout thing, when I was just like, you know, Prime, I know you're desperate, but of all things, you stuck two hooks in his eyes and pulled his head in half. It's like, Prime is bloodthirsty in this one, and I think it's just because it was the Peter Cullen voice, too, that made it even more jarring, because you're hearing this heroic 80s Prime, and going like, "Pull over," and you're like, "Oh, that's nice." And he, like, puts a gun against his head and blows a hole through the guy's head, and I'm like, That was cold.
Yeah. The only time Killer Prime really bothered me was at the beginning with Demolisher when, like, Demolisher's, he's broken, he's beaten. Optimus strolls up on him, is like, "Any last words?" Like, all Dirty Harry. And then, like, he says his piece, and then he's like, "Whatever." It's like, yeah, that seemed kind of much.
Everything else
you could say, it's like the heat of the battle. Like, you could pass it off that way. Like, he's fighting for his life. Sometimes you got to get a little messy. But that seemed awfully cold-blooded.
Yeah, I mean, but I contrasted that with the fact that Demolisher had just gone through a killing spree through the town, driving down the middle of the road, basically just running over hundreds of people. Yeah, maybe there was a different way he could handle it, but...
Well, you know, if Prime has always been like this, maybe Demolisher just panicked and was fleeing for his life, because he's...
Dude! Oh, crap! Sideways! Sideways saw the... Sideways saw the Autobots pull up, he flicked on his lights, he's like, "Oh, snap! I gotta get out of here!
And then he got cut in half, slowly. Like, he wasn't just cut in half... He had a blade shoved into his hood, and then he got to drive for a little while. Sideswipe's like, "Doot, doot, 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 I'm gonna scare him." He says, "Gonk! Oh, now you're in half." Demolisher was like, "I saw what he did to Dreadwing! He spent 3 days pulling him apart!"
The only one that really bothered me was, like Vangelis said, was at the end with the fall, and it's like, I don't know. Like,
that's not heat of battle. That was outright bloodlust. No one, even in the heights of panic, would say, "Give me your face."
But here's the part:
your face off. Here's another part: your heart and tear out your spine.
Here's another part I had with that scene, though. Okay, the whole shtick to the Fallen is he won't come to Earth because there's a Prime on Earth, and the only thing that can kill a Prime is another Prime, but
Optimus Prime was killed by Megatron. Megatron's not a Prime, so you know what's this whole big thing about being a Prime? I don't really get it.
I don't know if it was another Prime is the only one that can kill another Prime, but maybe it was because he was one of the first ones that it's some special.
Yeah, that was my explanation. Yeah, I mean I figured, but because he was one of the originals, but so that does make sense. I mean because so yeah. But it was just it still seemed to kind of be the whole another one of those holes in logic that you have to kind of explain to yourself. But if the Fallen was so crazy to where he could only be killed by a Prime, it just seems like it was kind of a strange way to die was to have your face ripped off. If you're this mythological being that's made out of metal and you lose your face and then you die, seemed like an odd way for the Fallen to go out.
Saying it like that, you'd think there'd be some sort of mystical spirit battle.
Yeah, well, I was looking forward to this epic, like, you know, Jet Prime, the heights of technology, who I was assuming was going to just go get the railgun and wield it as a cannon, versus the mystical powers of the Fallen, who's been built up this entire movie as, like, the robotic equivalent of Satan himself. And their fight was like 20 seconds long, completely one-sided, to the point where I actually felt bad for the Fallen. Because of the way that he got brutalized. Hey, someone wanted to say something. Seth, you had a message to pass on, didn't you?
Yeah, so, like, not long after we got started, I got a text message from a friend of the show, Derek J. Wyatt, as everybody knows from the animated series. So I said, hey, man, we're recording the podcast right now. Do you want me to say anything on your behalf? And he said, yes, tell everyone I said, give me your face! And he wrote it all in caps with an exclamation point.
He wants my small face from the middle of my giant square head?
Give me your small face!
Honestly, that line is going to be a line that I think will show up on YouTube clips for years to come.
Because oh, my God.
Such a jarring and, as I said, outright horrific moment.
Yeah, but that fight with the Fallen did seem anticlimactic.
It was.
Because
he's supposed to be, like you said, like he's the Transformer Satan, and he didn't really seem to put up much of a struggle. Like, he never got one good lick in on Prime that I could recall.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, the most the Fallen did was he stood on the pyramid, he teleported around it, landed on it, and then made a bunch of rocks levitate and took out three jets.
Yeah, and especially when you play the game and you face the Fallen in the game did it better, actually. Because there's an actual pitched battle, and the Fallen has a gun and things like that, and he can make fire come down from the sky and whatnot. And also, it's much like with Devastator being wasted potential, in my opinion. I felt the Fallen was equally wasted potential, because these were two climactic forces who could have been by themselves in a movie's entire final sequence. And they were just kind of both kind of mushed together into this kind of... The whole end of the movie felt to me like a whole bunch of ideas that they wanted to do, but didn't have the time to figure out how to deliver in a balanced way, and that was all even just kind of cherry on top was the ending, where after that fight, and Prime, like a gigantic dick, just sheds the corpse pieces of Jetfire as though they're nothing anymore. then we're on an aircraft carrier. He goes like, thanks for saving me, and then the movie's over.
Yeah, and it seemed maybe disappointing that Jetfire had to die for that to happen.
Yeah.
And I was hoping... And I imagined that what we were going to get would be a scene where Jetfire was like, I will lend you my power, like, I'm old too, like the Fallen, and I will give you our old school ability, and then there would be, like, the big, he comes flying in and transforms and clips on, and it's more like something out of, like, a big elaborate anime.
Yeah.
But instead, it was just, like, stick all the parts on with your... electric magnet
Autobot Jesus whips.
Yeah, and then and then all of a sudden Optimus Prime is Goku from Dragon Ball, where he's been getting his ass kicked until he reaches that new plateau of power, and now he's just like invincible and just like boom 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 three punches, and the villain that was indestructible up to that point is now quivering on the floor.
Literally a quivering.
Well, on the plus side though. On the plus side though, I mean Jetfire did get torn apart into pieces and put onto Prime. I mean, it's not like Jazz, who Optimus picked up and started doing ventriloquism. Yeah. I
mean. Although that's even worse, because it's like Jetfire didn't even combine with him. He was broken into pieces and attached to his body, and his whole sacrifice was just... It's just the way that Prime shrugged off one of the shoulder pieces. I was like, Prime, you dick.
Yeah. I mean, you... Well, Prime also never got to really meet Jetfire. I mean, like, he didn't know.
Jetfire should have just taken control of his consciousness or something, or just go, like, you know, appear as an ethereal ghost. Like, did you guys know that inside Optimus Prime's psyche is just a sea of blood and fire?
Yeah, or have an Obi-Wan moment where Prime is fighting with the Fallen. It looks like it could go either way, and then, Ghost Jetfire is, like, in Prime's head and is like, dude, this is what you gotta do. You gotta rip his head off. Or you gotta rip off his face.
Because face is a source
Prime,
of his power.
They had these magical helmets kind of thing.
Prime is like, what do I do? Jetfire's like, hey, listen closely. Ask him to give him your face. It's like, okay. Just ask him. Say, give me your face. Okay, give me your face! Ah! Automatic control kicks in! What did I do?
Oh, God!
My God, what did I do?
Oh, God! What am I doing?
Maybe Jetfire did do something like that. And it's like, I'm lost, what do I do? And Jetfire's whispering, you must avenge our race. And Prime thinks, he says, I must take your face!
And then you must tear his spine out and beat him with it until he's a quivering puddle. And then do that to one of your friends.
Tear his face off and then stick it right in the camera so everyone can see.
Yeah. And then shove it in place of his heart so now he has a face where his heart was and a heart where his face was.
And then pee on his body.
I was waiting for him to do that. He just rips the front off his crotch plate and goes like, and this is for America! And just like takes a huge leak on him. Homicidal Prime is one of my favorite things to talk about, just because there's so much potential in there, and it's probably never going to be tapped, because I'm sure it wasn't intentional, but it was just so scary, and I felt bad for all the Decepticons, and then you start imagining, over these last 2 years, what has he been doing to this race, you know, this murderous, you know, cadre of Transformers who... You know, maybe some of them just want social reform or something like that. And they go out to try to talk. Like, Prime, listen, I think that we have a bit of a messed up political hierarchy back home. And he just, like, shoves his hand through their stomach and pulls out their intestines. Goes like, this is what my democracy is! And shoves it down their mouth.
Wait, is it Shattered Glass Prime?
That was my first thought when he was doing all this. I was like, this reminds me of... Shattered Glass Prime and his, like, room of hanging corpses. Oh.
I want to see a Radicom's custom of Shattered Glass Prime where they somebody removes the Till All Are Gone and puts Gimme Your Face.
Yeah. Collectors Club Comic could feasibly do that. They could throw that in, you know? You guys hear us over here? You know, that would be a nice throwback. I don't know.
All I can say in Prime's defense is sometimes war gets ugly.
Sometimes war gets ugly, and sometimes you friggin' snap. Like, I was imagining the Lazarus Pit madness from Batman when Ra's al Ghul, you know, he goes nuts when he comes back to life. Maybe that happened to Prime. He was like, comes back, he's like, put that corpse on my body! Give me your face! And he goes like, Bumblebee, come over here! Bumblebee's like, I think my throat's working again. No, it isn't! He rips his throat out.
Well, it was on an Even podcast when, we were just first hearing about Prime and Jetfire combining. Didn't one of you guys make the joke of
Omega's.
Prime that grabbing Jetfire and smashing him onto his back?
Yeah. I did make the joke that he's just going to slap a dead Decepticon onto his back. I didn't know I'd come that close.
And I want to say, between that and between MC Paddington, we none of us have inside leaks. We were just lucky.
Shotgun approach. Just keep saying things. Eventually, one will stick.
Yeah, right. I would have never, in my wildest dreams, thought if I'd made a joke back then about Prime going on a murderous rampage and tearing bodies open. You know, I'd...
tearing faces off.
I just got another.
No, you did.
From,
you did.
Oh my God! I did.
It was following when I made the Jetfire comment.
Right, because Prime snaps and he kicks Sam and stuff like
right.
that.
Till all are gone!
Oh my god.
Oh
anyway,
my god.
Seth, you got a text message?
Yeah, I got another message from Wyatt. He just said, and you're going to love this, he just said, can you imagine if Prime took Vangelis's tiny face?
Honestly, I think that's a good place to end, really. We've been going on for about 2 hours or so on our end, and there's probably more to talk about, but I'm thinking we're hitting that kind of fatigue wall.
Well, I think we should go around and everybody do like a final thoughts.
Yeah.
Kind of wrap it up where maybe we don't interject into each other. We just, everyone gets their own little couple minutes.
Yeah, everyone get your final thought little section. I'll just go top to bottom on the list again. Aaron, final thoughts on Revenge of the Fallen.
Bumblebee got massive Energon roids. For his fight scene there, going from the guy that managed to get both of his legs blown off to taking out multiple Decepticons, and in a matter of a few moments, he definitely got the badass upgrade. The end.
Excellent. Yeah, I agree. Gog, your final thoughts?
I'm still a little conflicted. I want to see it again a second time. I think my expectations really worked against me on the first viewing. Specific examples like the characterization of both Jetfire and the Fallen. With Jetfire, I was really expecting kind of just like this old, you know, rugged, hardcore dude, and instead we got this totally bouncy, completely senile Scotsman. so there's just some things that that just kind of took me by surprise, and I'm not sure how I feel, and I want to see it again. Overall, I think a lot of the complaints I had with the first one were fixed. Characterization for the bad guys, better scenes without the shaky cam and action where you can tell what's going on. But again, a lot of the complaints I had with the first one were as bad or worse than this one, like the humor. A lot of the humor was just completely out of place. It completely took me out of the movie at times. I will say, overall, I enjoyed the movie. I think it's a heavily flawed movie, but one that I can look past the flaws for the most part to see the good. I'm still, though, like I had said earlier, it still leaves me, though, with a thought in my head, like, of what it could have been, you know, for the reasons that I've already said. So, I enjoyed the movie. I would like to see the third one go in a new direction with maybe a little more clear and concise plot with the stakes more clearly defined.
Mm-hmm. And Lupus, your final thoughts on Revenge of the Fallen?
I'm still torn over it because I had really high expectations for it, and as we've already covered, it did seem like there was too many cooks in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested to see how the third one is going to end up, considering all the rumors and the whispers. But on the other hand, I think it might be great that we're getting a three-year break. This and the next one. So, I don't know. I'm going to give it another shot in IMAX, and this time completely shut off the brain, which probably what I should have done before. I'm going to give it another shot.
All right. And Seth?
Yeah, well, with the first one, I came away with it with some issues, but subsequent viewings, I was able to sort of get over the problems I had. I'm kind of expecting to feel that way in subsequent viewings of this movie also. There was some really good stuff in this movie. There was also some pretty bad bits. So right now, if I had to give it like a 5-star rating, like using that scale, right now I'm going to say 2.
Mm-hmm.
And that I like the first movie better. But that's right now. And this is what I saw the movie, what we've been recording for a while. The movie started 8 hours ago. So I haven't really gotten all my feelings down yet. And I'd just also like to throw in that I loved Ravage. I thought Ravage was just so awesome. And whatever that thing, the millions of BBs that he barfed up, that all formed into... Like, we make jokes about characters being made out of knives. There was literally a character made out of knives. And that could be a whole big thing. I'll just leave it at that. But that thing was kind of weird looking. But, like, just the way Ravage moved, like, when he was, like, kind of off in the distance providing cover fire for Knifatron, just, it was so... Oh, man. I thought they did such an awesome job with Ravage. I was so happy with Ravage. It makes... any three things that I didn't like about the movie go away just because I thought Ravage was so well done.
Definitely. And Omegas, your final thoughts?
Well, I'm a little bit gentler on the movie. I wasn't going in expecting the flawless Transformer experience or anything like that. I knew going in I was just going to watch it for what it was and try to enjoy it that way. That being said, I think there was too much humor interjected into it, and really too many characters that were just getting lost in the shuffle. I mean, if you took out the twins and put RC and Sideswipe in that spot during the whole movie, you'd probably solve both of the problems right there. Mm. But overall, it's not the mind... I guess seeing the first movie just kind of takes away some of the mind-blowing aspects of it. But I didn't mind the movie so much. I did enjoy it for what it was. And, you know, I'm hoping the sequel is going to be better. There's a lot of lessons to learn here. But overall, scale 1 to 10, I'd probably give it 7 out of 10 Constructicles.
Excellent.
Would that be 14?
I just love that word.
My own thoughts would definitely be, as I said, I actually reworded my thoughts a few times. Used to be it was a positive experience. Used to be I had fun watching it. The best way I can put it, I think, for everyone on all sides of the board would be I think it was a feasibly entertaining experience. Definitely many problems with the movie. Definitely many things I enjoyed. Sadly, I think, and I always state this, I think a lot of the problems people fixate on are really the smallest ones, and there isn't enough healthy discussion of things like, for instance, you know, crazy pacing, uncomfortable, awkward parts, etc., etc. Generally, I enjoyed it, and I'm definitely not going to defend a lot of parts of it. I'm not going to come down on people for liking parts of it. And really, I think that this whole podcast we just recorded exemplifies something I wish the movie forum would take to heart, which is that it's perfectly fine to have opinions about a movie in any direction so long as you don't insult other people for not having those opinions and disagreeing with yours.
No, it's not.
And basically, that's what we just did, so we rock. Ha. And I enjoyed it. There's lots more we could talk about, but... it's not something you can really cover all in one sitting. And
Soundwave was cool. Soundwave was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I liked little Knifatron, actually. I liked him a lot. Apparently he's called Overkill because he's like a Velociraptor thing, I've been told. But I like...
all right.
I can't remember where anyone said... I think that might have just been conjecture, but, you know, it works. But yeah, that's our movie supplemental. I'm sure we'll talk about the movie off and on as time goes on. But... if you want to hear more of my own thoughts, I actually recorded a video gabbing about the movie in front of a camera right before we did this. So there's more of my thoughts there. I'm sure these guys will have replies to make in the thread, whatnot. All I'm going to ask, if you're discussing this in the thread, don't be, you know, stupid and argumentative and fist-fighty, because I'll make fun of you. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed listening to this. Thanks for staying tuned in, and until next time, ladies and gentlemen, that was Vangelis, Aaron, Gogdog, Lupus, Seth, and Omegas Prime, and we are WTF and TFW discussing Revenge of the Fallen, and now we're going to go off and rip off your face.
What the f*** it means, but you got some badass perpetrators, and they're here to stay.
You
think you have seen the last of me, producer? You think you have downsized the spoiler section? You are wrong. As long as mankind crafts tales of excitement and wonder, and as long as men and women, young and old, look forward to them, there will be spoilers to ruin the surprise. I will return. That is my final spoiler for now.